well, if you can put a price on carbon,
yeah,
what about putting a price on, I don't know, the Swift parrot? Could that save it?
Exactly. Yes. And as you mentioned on Friday, the Environmental Film Festival has been in Hobart this weekend. And the last screening is at the Stanley Burberry Theatre tonight, and it's called Banking Nature. And it's a very interesting look at the origin of this idea of putting a price on nature. So that, so we've got used to the idea of a price on carbon and on water. And
who started it, Ted? Where did the idea come from?
Well, it really started in the 70s when there was an argument that that public funds and charity and goodwill was not enough to save biodiversity, and we had to bring in the private sector,
Market.
We had to
that'll
bring
sort
in the
it
market.
Out
exactly. Yep. And it's a false premise for a start, because if you look at all of our national parks and protected areas, I mean, 50% of Tasmania is in national parks and protected areas. That's public sector. 24% of the United States, 30% of Costa Rica. I mean, you know, so to say that the public sector has failed is a false premise for a start. But there is an argument to say there is room for private capital or for markets when it comes to things that are easily definable and exchangeable, like carbon and water. A gigalitre of water over here is much the same as a gigalitre of water over there. As soon as you start talking about nature and biodiversity, you know, is that hectare of woodland equivalent to that one over there? And that's become the thorny issue.
Well, in a way, that conversation's been provoked in Australia about water, but giving water rights to the farmers.
Yep.
And there was a commentator, and I can't remember who it was, saying, but water's not just about farming. Water has values to other communities and other people who now may not have a say in it.
Yeah, well, that's what's happened in the Murray-Darling Basin. It still has some time to play out, but at least what's happened is there was agreement about allocating a certain amount, I think it's around 2,850 gigalitres, to the environment. So they made that agreement first, that the river needs this much to survive and be in good condition. Then they said, well, what's that worth and how do we price it? And that price is fluctuating. It's up around $2,000 a megalitre in Hobart at the moment. If you look at your domestic water bill, we pay $950 a megalitre or 95 cents a kilolitre. So it's finding a price where it's going to go and have its greatest impact. So that market is starting to operate, and it is too early to pass judgment, but at least it started with agreement that a certain amount needs to be allocated to the river. As soon as you start taking that idea of tradable markets into biodiversity, it gets highly dubious, and that's what this film is really exploring. There's some very inventive financial instruments. There are actually 700 banks have emerged in America called mitigation banks, some of them just around one species, one rare species, and they sell you credits so that you can go and build a Walmart or build a housing estate in a certain environment that is otherwise threatened and protected, because they've bought a big slab of it, and then those funds go into maintaining and protecting that block of it. But it does get highly dubious.
What about, do you know the story of this, is the flower-loving sandfly, the
yes.
world's most expensive
yes.
insect?
Yeah, and that
illustrates this so beautifully.
That's a classic example of where our value system is starting to get highly questionable, because what it illustrates is that rarity as a basis of value in nature doesn't really make a whole lot of sense. I mean, we value things because they're rare. That's a particularly human trait. It's almost an economic definition, isn't it?
It's why people watch The Bachelor.
But it doesn't reflect what they do. Now, I don't know what the Delhi sandflower-loving fly does in that ecosystem. If I knew about it, say, if it was played a major role in pollination, you've got a very strong case for it. If you look at the devil in Tasmania, Tasmanian devil, it's threatened because of the facial tumour disease. But so it's not only its level of threat and its potential rarity, it's the role it plays in the ecosystem. It's a top predator. If you protect a top predator, you've got to protect its habitat, its prey, and you carry a lot with it. But at the moment, we put rarity above all else. We have an act, the Environmental Protection and Biodiversity Conservation Act, has 1,400 species listed under it. Each has to have a recovery plan. We throw millions of dollars at them. Very few have ever come up that list. It's just growing. Saltwater crocodile came off.
Mm. Are you saying then, so the fight to save the swift parrot, for example, based on its rarity, there's only a few of them and we must be worried or they'll disappear, is not rational. It's about what's the swift parrot's role.
It's not entirely rational.
We've got heaps of parrots filling that niche. That niche is fine. Just don't worry about it.
No, I mean, things have their own particular value, and I understand people's attachment to things that are rare, but I'm just saying it's been taken to the level of absurdity with these biodiversity credits and these 700 mitigation banks that have emerged in America.
Because presumably you can increase the value of your bank by reducing the number of the animal you're meant to be protecting.
Well, this is the thing, you see. Markets abhor things that are free or abundant. So they're attracted to things that are rare and endangered and listed. Where's the incentive to make them abundant?
No, well, you'd kill your business.
Exactly.
It's ridiculous.
But the other thing that this documentary raises, it traces the origin of this right back to the backlash against the environmental movement in the 70s, the interest in financial markets. But then it takes it up to the point where it looks at what happened to mortgages in the financial crisis. Now, so if these biodiversity credits are traded in highly speculative secondary markets, people don't know what it is they're actually trading and dealing with, and it's the existence of things in nature. So it's not that we shouldn't put a price on nature. If we didn't do that, we wouldn't have such a thing as private property. It's what bounds do we put around it? How do we regulate it? And at the moment, this idea of offsets is really like indulgences in the church. You know, that this is what led to the Reformation, this whole absurd idea that you could pay a certain amount of money to the church and then go and sin at will. Well, a lot of this offsetting is very similar to that. And so I think what's interesting is...
It's just the church that's benefiting is your airline as you fly. Isn't it? Just another $5, you can carbon offset, you can fly guilt-free.
Yeah, well, look, if you look at the carbon...
While you get squashed into your...
Yeah. Because markets haven't always worked, doesn't mean we shouldn't use them. It means we should look carefully at how we define their limits and how we govern them. So the carbon market in Europe has done nothing for reducing carbon emissions yet. But that doesn't mean we should abandon the idea of carbon markets. It doesn't mean we should abandon the idea of tradable permits. But it just means that the rules as they currently exist have the potential to do even more damage than they do good.
This film's on?
It's on tonight, 6 o'clock, Stanley Burberry Theatre. It's called Banking Nature. Very interesting documentary.
Great to talk to you, Ted.
You too. Thanks.
Ted Lefroy, Director for the Centre for Environment at the University of Tasmania.